Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Had to play a little segment of Ornette Coleman. We just lost him. He's a very influential jazz artist to several generations now.
And thanks to recordings like the one we just heard, we can still tap our toes and enjoy.
Exactly.
All right. Well, here we are on this Kamehameha Day and a lot to talk about. Thanks very much for joining us. Now, 2 days ago, the Kapalama Canal saw a lot of comings and goings. Crews collected the belongings of the homeless people living along the canal and cleaned up after them. The crew was enforcing Honolulu's stored property ordinance. Hours later, the homeless people returned. The cycle is ordinary and costly. According to the city, the weekly price tag to enforce the law is $15,000. Jenny Lee believes that money and the funds to create temporary housing at Sand Island could be better used. She's the public policy director for Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. She's in our studio this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
That's a lot of money when you start to think about how much it might cost to get a unit for someone if there were a subsidy available, or maybe even if there weren't. And if you're talking about getting a unit for somebody at about $1,000 a month, to think about what $15,000 weekly could buy, plus the additional funds that are being used for Sand Island. Why isn't this really being talked about with sort of a cost-benefit analysis?
I think that there's such concern that people see that we've reached a crisis point in terms of homelessness. This issue has been kicked down the road for quite some time now, and therefore there's a feeling that we need to take immediate concrete action that people can see. So similar with the sit-lie bans, there's an approach thinking that if we just sweep people out of this area by removing their property, or we try to put people in Sand Island, if we can present some kind of solution, then it indicates progress. But we think that there are other options that also would make more of an impact and be more cost efficient. So that figure of $15,000, you could give a full voucher for a year to at least a couple, and that many of the people experiencing homelessness are actually working or would be able to, with supportive services, find employment of some kind. We do have a low unemployment rate. And then, therefore, even if it's part-time, be able to give some income to help reduce the amount of that subsidy. So we think it could go far with a shallow form of subsidy as well.
Your point that, okay, people want to see something happening immediately. They want to see some action on this. Well, seeing people removed from an area or their belongings removed from an area, obviously that's immediate action. But then you get one right after that where people come back. Surely people are seeing that too. In light of what you've just said, is there any movement to look at this idea of putting them into housing and doing what we've all been talking about for such a long time with Housing First?
The city council did allow a shallow subsidy in its provision for funds for homeless programs. So that is an option should the city administration decide to exercise it. And we do think this really should be pursued because it is a cost-efficient way to address it, and I think it's promising. So we're looking at a lot of things that we either know don't work or haven't tried before. And we say, okay, this is a good option, like Sand Island. We are considering this, and we'll just see if it works, and then maybe we'll replicate it. But this is an option that we also have not tried, taking a coordinated approach to really help place people who are in these situations where they are far from ideal. I think there's a distinction between Kapalama and Kaka'ako. You do have certain things like being right near the stream, issues with waste disposal that do present some health concerns. So I think that's a real emergency area where we need a coordinated placement effort. And rental assistance is a huge part of that.
So why all the myopia on the Sand Island option?
I think that it's to some extent looking at options that have been successful in some sense elsewhere. So in the West Coast, particularly the Pacific Northwest, there have been these kind of voluntary communities that arose organically out of encampments and people self-selecting to enter into them. But the residents tend to be there longer term. They have a real interest in being a part of that community. So I've spoken with some of those folks in Oregon, and there's a real passion for being a part of that. Sand Island is essentially another emergency shelter. And we know that the exit outcomes for exit destinations for people coming out of emergency shelters, more than half of them are going back into homelessness. So we need to see that Sand Island is not really some kind of transitional housing. Emergency shelter placement is one acceptable outcome. And then also we know that the outcomes, it is a struggle. And it's not to say point fingers or say it's anybody's fault necessarily, but what's going to make Sand Island different? I think we can't underestimate the importance of the location and the disruption that's coming to people from a sense of breaking apart from their community and going out there. It's not simply barriers to entering shelters, but those kind of things also matter. And those kind of goals by people who are unsheltered, what their priorities are and what they care about. We really need to look at the comprehensive set of barriers. Why aren't they going into the existing shelter beds, especially when we have 150 vacant emergency shelter beds and then another 450 in transitional housing, which is what the step is supposed to be to get you into permanent housing, but people aren't there.
Why aren't they there?
I think some of those issues related to there has been more discussion about some of the barriers in terms of how people feel about the policies in a shelter, whether or not they can live with their partner, whether or not they can have a pet there, the periods where the shelters close, they have to leave very early, they can't come back till later. So those kinds of things, they do make life more difficult for people who have experienced trauma and are really struggling. Location also matters, whether people feel they're close to where they want to live or even close to resources, jobs, libraries, all these sorts of things where they're, you know, that any of us would want in our community. So I think it's multifaceted, but we need to take a hard look at that, because what's the difference again with Sand Island? And that's one of the most difficult locations. It does not look very hospitable and it's not very conveniently located. So until we really identify that, if we're talking about this being a promising model, well, it's a little cart before the horse to think about where are we beginning, what's the problem we're looking to solve. And it's not simply going to be a kind of private 40-square-foot space to put your belongings in. Those are improvements, but we should consider what's going on then, what's good about this proposal that we could try to look at how we can implement elsewhere.
What you seem to be saying is that there are more redundancies with the Sand Island plan than there are benefits. Would that be true?
At least in terms of what the number of beds are, I think that's there, and that some of the things, the aspects that we can probably all look at and support could be replicated elsewhere, including the, in addition to the emergency shelter beds, as I think, again, we have to emphasize, this really is an emergency shelter with a 60-day time limit on residing there. Also looking at the intake, there's an idea that this is kind of a one-stop shop to come in and do intake. Well, it's in an incredibly isolated location. That would not be my first choice for where I try to go. So we do have certain options for where sites where people can go for intake, existing service providers, but they're very, very popular, which is a great sign. People want access to these services. But I think we should take a look at expanding staffing and the number of people already at shelters or other sites where people experiencing homelessness may congregate. So, for example, a food distribution site. What if we had, even if it was just one day a week, a part-time intake site that we could start connecting people where they're already going, where they're comfortable, instead of building infrastructure and an entire new program?
And that's been the point all along, that in terms of doing any sort of triage, you already know where homeless people are or where they would congregate if there were something given to them at a point where they need it, like the food.
Right. And we also have great teams of street outreach workers who consistently go out there and really try to maintain and build trust with these clients and then do that exact process, go through the assessment, the vulnerability index, and then help them connect with the services. And that kind of trust-building relationship with these dedicated staff is really important. SitLi, though, has been one component that's disrupted that.
As you look at where we are right now, and given all the things that you've just said, what do you think is the assessment that decision-makers are looking at? Are they actually looking at the same sets of information that you are?
I think that some of the pieces of information have not come out in as much of a public discussion about the number of people who are capable of a rapid rehousing approach. It's not only housing first, but there are cost-efficient things we can do to address the populations we're really concerned about. We know that our policymakers do care about these people and are trying to think of, well, what can we do in terms, particularly of Sand Island, like, is this a more humane option or something that people would be open to? So when they start considering what works, what will people respond to, that's a step in the right direction, but we have to look at the data that's been collected by groups like Focus to understand that and then see also input what's keeping residents out of unsheltered people out of shelters and out of housing. So that's really the point to start at, is that information, what is going to be successful through that kind of analysis.
And on that point where you say that we should start, we have to end for the moment. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Beth Ann.
Jenny Lee is a public policy director for Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice. She's also the secretary of the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii and on the board of Housing Hawaii.